Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25. If you remember the last time we were together, Abraham passes away at the age of 175. Ishmael's around 88 years old. Isaac's 75 years old. Jacob and Esau are 15 years old. And Rebekah is there as well. And I want you to kind of put yourself a little bit in this scenario as a child, when both of your parents pass away, because that's where Isaac and Ishmael find themselves in this moment, that both Sarah and Abraham have died and they've been buried back close to Mamre. And to go, whenever you've had these spiritual giants as parents, spiritual leaders, what kind of questions do you come up with when someone like that passes away? Okay. Some may think, why? Right, and we see so many things on a physical side, but I want you to think about the spiritual aspect of this. Chuck. Right, how do I build upon what was given to me? You've been given exposure to these things, and we start to kind of ask questions like, well, what's the direction that it's going to go now? What's the way to go? What's the best route? Maybe you think in terms of who's going to pick up the pieces and go from here. And sometimes whenever a child loses both of their parents, it almost leaves you feeling like you're a little untethered. You have the generations after you, but you no longer have the ones that were ahead of you. And so you have to really dig in and go, all right, what's the direction that we're going to take this family now? And so you see exactly where Abraham is. He's already been buried. Now we come to Isaac and Ishmael. And if you look down in Genesis 25 and look at verse 12, he's going to use verses 12 through 18 to describe, and here's what's going to happen in the lineage of Ishmael. And here's what's going to happen with his sons. Then in verses 19 moving forward, it's going to talk about Isaac, and it's going to begin to bring up the descendants that are going to come through him and Rebekah. And so I want to make sure that whenever we look at these things, we don't just see another lineage that flows through, but I want you to understand these things in light of the promises that God specifically gave to Abraham, that even though Abraham is dead physically, look at how God considers his promises. Just because somebody dies doesn't mean, okay, well, those promises are no more. Look back in Genesis chapter 17. Look at verses 1 through 5. Now, when Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. This is the El Shaddai, the overpowerer. Walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. He says, here's my covenant. I am going to multiply you. I am the one who can take care of all my promises to keep them. I am the El Shaddai. And God only uses this term, or this term is only given about God, whether it's himself or someone else saying it five times in the book of Genesis. And it only shows up just a couple more times after this. But here, as it comes to this point, Abraham hears this statement from the El Shaddai, and look at his response in verse 3. Abraham fell on his face. When you encounter God who says, you know I have the power to keep my promises. I am going to multiply you. You will be exceedingly great. He says, I'm going to establish it. You walk before me and be blameless. And so Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him. Because of this worshipful response from God, God continues to speak to Abram. And he says these things in verses 4 and 5. As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you will be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I will make you the father of a multitude of nations. And so when you look at verses 4 and 5 together, really specifically, the promise here is about, I'm going to multiply you. He says, I'm going to multiply you. I'm going to multiply nations. There's going to be a multitude of nations. And you consider at this point in time, Abram is 99 years old, and the only son that he has biologically at this point is Ishmael. And so here's the promise that Abram hears. Now his name's going to change from this time forward to be Abraham. And another little side note, Genesis chapter 17 through Genesis chapter 21 only covers 1 year. Realize all these things through these chapters cover 1 year. You might could squeeze a little, maybe a few more months out of it. But to go, this, all these things are working together within a relatively short time. Now, look down at verse 20 in Genesis chapter 17. As Abraham is still talking with God, God starts to tell him what's going to happen with Sarah. They're going to have a son about this time next year. His name's going to be Isaac. But look at verse 20. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. Now, at this point in time, Ishmael's about 13 or 14 years old. And he says, I'm going to make of him, I'm going to multiply him exceedingly. He's going to be fruitful. I'm going to make of him a great nation. There's going to be 12 princes that are born of him. Can you imagine seeing a 13, 14-year-old son, and God says, by the way, he's going to have 12 sons. Wow, that's something. Now, you see the promises that God gave to Abram slash Abraham. Look back over now at Genesis 25 and look at verse 12 and start to notice to see these promises be fulfilled. Genesis 25, 12. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael. Now he's about to list them off. Now remember, the promise was for 12 princes. So I'll let you do your own counting here as we read them. See how many you come up with. He says in verse 13, and these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names in the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Keter, and Adbeel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massa, Hadad, and Tema, Jeter, Naphish, and Kadamah. How many did you come up with? 12 on the dot, right? So you start to notice here, here's what you see. It's so easy to come to these verses and go, I can't even pronounce some of these names. What's going on here? What's the reality of why these names are really being given? So that we can know what? That the El Shaddai has kept his promise. He has said he's going to have 12 princes, and now, guess who? What you have? Now you have names to go with those 12 sons. So here's these things playing out. Let me give you a little extra couple of details here. If you notice in verse 13, the firstborn son is Nebaioth. Later on in Genesis, there's going to be two names that are given as sisters of these 12. So now we're getting up to maybe there's 14 siblings among this group. So you can understand, let's see, what was the promise God said about these people? The descendants of Abraham were going to multiply exceedingly. Well, you start having 14 children at a time, things grow pretty quick, right? So, some other things that come around. The next son that's given is Keter, or K-E-D-A-R. Keter is going to be perhaps the one son out of these 12 that's really going to go on to be a mighty multitude of people. Later on, this name, Keter and his descendants, are going to go all the way through later on times with the days of Solomon, the days of perhaps even David. One of the Psalms of Ascent, Psalm 120, mentions about the people of Keter or the tents of Keter. And then you also have Isaiah talks about them, Jeremiah talks about them, Isaiah talks about them. They're still around in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, Jeremiah, whenever he writes about them. And realize, that's over a span of like 1,000 years. And so realize, did they really become a great multitude of people? They certainly did. And it's even talked about with Nebaioth and Keter in the book of Isaiah about their tents are so many. It's like even their flocks are of this vast, vast amount. They're just talked about as people of renown in terms of how massive they are in terms of numbers. Yet at the same time, here's just a little side note for you. Present day, the Muslims claim to be descendants of Ishmael. They also claim that that descendants of Muhammad comes through Keter, just to let you know. Now, whether that's true or false, I'll leave that up to you to look out for yourself. But notice this other aspect. Several of these names that are in here, you know nothing more about, really. The giving of these 12 is also written over in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 29 through 31. It's a retelling of these same names. But other than these two accounts of the sons of Ishmael, Adbeel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Massa, Hadad, Tema, and Kedema are not mentioned anywhere else. There's sometimes a name that's the same, but it's not the same person. And you know that because of the distance of time. Through all of these different peoples, you realize, let me give you another detail about how these things kind of dovetail together. Look over at 1 Chronicles chapter 5. We'll look forward about 400 years. First Chronicles chapter 5, look down at verse 18. As Chronicles is chronologically laying out the descendants of Israel, you get in chapter 5 the stories of some of the descendants of Reuben. And so in verse 18 it says, the sons of Reuben and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And if you remember, these two and a half tribes all lived on the east side of the Jordan River. They were not part of the mainland people. They took what was over on the east side. He says, consisting of valiant men, men who bore shield and sword and shot with bow and were skilled in battle, were 44,760 who went to war. They made war against the Hagrites, Jeter, Naphish, and Nodab. You notice those two names in the middle? Jeter and Naphish? Those are descendants later on lineage in the line of Ishmael. These are his two sons, and later on they become great peoples, but I want you to notice what happens with them. Now keep in mind, this is some 500 years later or more. Notice how it continues, verse 20. They were helped against them, and the Hagrites, and all who were with them were given into their hand, for they cried out to God in the battle, and he answered their prayers because they trusted in him. So now you start to notice the descendants that come through Isaac, Jacob, and then these his sons that come with him, specifically here, Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe Manasseh, now having war against the ones who are the descendants of Ishmael through Jeter and Naphish. And so all of a sudden you see this battle, and of course this is after the giving of the promised land. But I want you to notice something about the people of God. With Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe Manasseh, they're getting ready to go to battle, who do they call on? They pray to God. They cried out to God, and he responded to their prayer. Why does he respond to their prayer? Because they trust him. And why should they put their faith in God? What did he give to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob? He gave them a promise that this land would be theirs. This is part of God's will, that they knew about God's promises. And now they're putting their trust in God and they pray to him. And what happens? He responds just the way he promised he would, right? Do we have that same kind of conviction whenever we go, I know what God promised me. Am I going to pray to him for it and then trust that he will give? Are we responding in a faithful way like this? So you also notice some of these descendants, they go to war and they get killed among those of Ishmael with Jeter and Naphish. Now, come back over to Genesis chapter 25. So whenever you read through some of these names, I just want you to realize there's a little bit more to some of these stories. We're not going to go down this road too much further. Chuck. Right. Right. They don't know all the details, but they know the promise. Then, here in Genesis 25, look at how this continues, verse 16. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names, by their villages and by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. In other words, just the way God said it would be. May we never be people who take for granted when God makes a promise. And I really want to make an impression on us all through the book of Genesis. If God makes a promise, you can go ahead and count it as being achieved. It will happen. And if you notice it here, once again, just keeping a promise. I told you there'd be 12 sons. Here's 12 sons. I told you I'd multiply you. I'm multiplying you. I told you there would be many nations that would come out of this. And those of Keter, they're going to be a big nations. Then, notice how it continues on, verse 17. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And you think, Ishmael doesn't live as long as his father. He lives to be 137. And at the same time, when you start thinking in terms of 137, Ishmael's about 13 or 14 years behind him. I mean, Isaac's 13 or 14 years behind Ishmael in age. So he's about 123, 124 whenever his brother dies in terms of Ishmael. Then, if you follow through here, it says he breathed his last and died, gathered to his people, and is turning into a lot of people. I mean, he's got 12 sons and one or two daughters that are mentioned by name. And then, verse 18, they settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria. He settled in defiance of all his relatives. What does that tell you about the heart of Ishmael? Still a donkey, just as what was said. And you realize, with all these things together, here he settles through all of this land from Havilah. Go back in your mind to Genesis chapter 2. If you remember when I talked about the four rivers that came out of the garden, one of them was the Pishon River, which flows down around the land of Havilah, which that's where you harvest gold. That's where you find it. And so you realize, here's these people who are living down here east of Egypt. And as you may be thinking already, of course they'd be close to Egypt because where is Ishmael's mother from? She's from Egypt. So you can kind of see maybe a similarity there. So you see, here's the descendants of Ishmael. Then, now he's going to come through and talk about the descendants of Isaac. Now, if you notice, typically we think about Genesis generally being in chronological order, but I want you to know there are times where it is certainly not. And so if you notice, it's already given you a time period where if it was a parallel, Isaac would already be 123, 124 years old. But the story you're about to read, he's going to start off at 40, and then he's going to be 60. So it's like, let me tell you the whole story of Ishmael and let you understand that God did keep his promises. He did multiply them. There are many nations that are born out of him, and there were 12 sons. He says, let me tell you that full length of the story. And then he's going to come over and says, now let's talk about Isaac. Notice how this continues. Verse 19. So these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. So now it brings you right back to the tail end of chapter 24. Whenever Isaac and Rebekah are married, I know I told you this all along, that he was 40 years old, and I'm sure you're thinking, why does he keep on saying that? It doesn't say that back in chapter 24, because I had already read ahead to chapter 25. So you see what's going on here. Rebekah and Isaac are married. They're married at the age where he is 40. It doesn't give you her age. And then I want you to notice what happens next. Because in verse 21, it's going to start to give you some more details about what is coming. But before you see this, I want you to go back again and look at a promise that God made to Abraham. Look back at Genesis 22. I want these things to make such a deep impression on us that whenever we see a promise of God, we just go, he's going to do it. And not have to second guess ourselves or wonder. Because whenever you find conviction in the promises of God, you find conviction to carry you through today's troubles, knowing that God's already got this taken care of. Then, Genesis 22, if you remember, he's already gone up to Mount Moriah to offer up his son Isaac. And, of course, he's been told he doesn't have to. Then notice here in verse 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, all caps, covenant God, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, talking about Isaac, indeed I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gates of their enemies. Now think about this promise. In verse 17, he says, I will greatly bless you. Talking about Abraham, he says, and I will greatly multiply your seed. And notice seed is singular. Specifically, if you were a Hebrew and reading the book of Genesis, you would see seed. And as you continue to read, you would think of who? You would think of Isaac. Later on in the New Testament, in Galatians chapter 3, who's going to be referred to as the seed? It's going to be Jesus. So no, there's kind of a double entendre here. So as he continues on, he says, multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. He says, I'm going to multiply you this far. To think in terms of not just the stars of the heavens. And here's something I want you to really consider. In the night sky, when you look up, can you even see all the stars? No, because your vantage point is only seeing a certain percentage of the night sky, right? You're not seeing everything that's on the other side of the planet. And to realize, then he goes on to say, and as the sand which is on the seashore, how multiplied is the sand? Anybody want to volunteer to count just enough that would fit in your hands? Let alone the seashore. He says, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. Sure enough, is God already doing this? That the descendants of Isaac are possessing the gates of their enemies? Like, say, the descendants of Jeter and Naphesh? You see, those promises have already come true from what we've already read in 1 Chronicles 5. He says, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. Verse 18, in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. because of your faithful obedience. He says, I have sworn by myself, declares the Lord. What does that tell you? The certainty of these things. It will happen. You just watch. Then, if you notice these things together, he's already talked about multiplying nations, and we've already looked at some of these things, like Keturah's son, Midian. He becomes a great nation later on. We looked at that last week. But you see these promises. Now come back to Genesis 25, and look at verse 21. Isaac knows these promises. You might think, well, Kerry, how do you know that he knows these promises? Because Abraham was circumcised. And you remember what the circumcision promise was about? It was about a promised land. It was this land would be for your descendants, Abraham. Specifically, Isaac. They also talk about in terms of, and there'll be as many descendants as there are stars in the sky. Sand on the seashore. And it was about through one seed. So this promise is not about the descendants that we just read in Genesis 22. It's not about the descendants of Ishmael or the descendants that came through Keturah and her six sons. This is a promise specifically through Isaac. And at this point in time, Isaac and Rebekah are married. But what's lacking? She's barren. They don't have any children. But what has God made? A covenant promise. The El Shaddai has made a covenant promise. Genesis 25, verse 21. Isaac prayed to the covenant God. Now, why would he pray to the covenant God? What is he aware of? The promise. He says, on behalf of his wife, because she was barren, and the covenant God answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Notice the response here. Isaac knows about these promises. So he prays to the covenant God, and the covenant God responds. Now, you'll find out later on, we'll get to the age when we get a little bit further on here. She's conceived. Now, I don't know what the prayer is. It doesn't give it to us, but I think there's going to be something beyond what was actually prayed for. Verse 22. Here's a little curious detail right off the bat. But the children, But the children struggled together within her. She was barren, and now she's conceived, but it's not just one. Now it's at least two, right? I don't know if we have anybody in here who had twins, but that is quite a little bit of a shock whenever they go to do the little ultrasound test nowadays, and we've prayed to have this child, and then all of a sudden they go, I hear two heartbeats. Huh? Well, here she is, and she'd been barren before, prayed to the Lord, Lord answered. The children struggled within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire of the covenant God. I know the covenant that's been made. Apparently Isaac has shared these things with her. She's like, why such a struggle? And it is such a unique little thing, even when there's just one child in the womb, when all of a sudden this beautifully round belly now has a corner to it, maybe with a foot or an elbow or something. But think about it, here's these two children that are struggling within the womb. That can't be comfortable for an expectant mother. He says, so she went to inquire of the Lord, because who would know? Who would know such a detail? But the covenant God who gave this promise to have descendants. And now here's two at once, but she doesn't know it yet. Now think about that. When did people of old discover they were having twins? At birth, right? I mean, I've been told some interesting stories in terms of going, here's the first child. Oh, there's another. A little bit of a shock. Verse 23, here's how the Lord responds, the covenant God responds to her. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two nations. Now, if you think about that, here she's asking about, this is a covenant relationship. Why are there such a struggle? And she inquires of the Lord, and the covenant God said to her, two nations are in your womb. Which two nations are they? The descendants of Jacob are going to be called the Israelites, and the descendants of Esau are going to be called the Edomites. Here's two nations. I want you to realize how God is talking about them. He doesn't say, and someday these men will become nations. He says, there's two nations inside of you. Two nations. I don't know that that would make an expectant mother super happy. But at the same time, two nations are in your womb. Now, she didn't know what we know. He says, and two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. What is God revealing? I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Is that the way we see the covenant relationship that we have with God? He's going to tell us what's going to happen. When it says God is faithful, it says you're going to reap what you sow. What do you know for certain? If you're going to sow to the flesh, you're going to reap flesh. If you're going to sow to the Spirit, you're going to reap from the Spirit. Maybe you think about other passages. That's, of course, Galatians chapter 6. Maybe other passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where it talks about God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able to bear, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape for you to endure. God's faithful. So what do you know every time you're tempted? What do you know? Is the way of escape always going to be present? Yes. Will you be able to endure it if you respond to God out of that? Absolutely. Responding out of love is always the way out of temptation. It's there every time. So you realize these promises that are given back here in terms of covenant promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, realize under the new covenant there are these promises to us, and to realize that we have just as much reassurance to say God is certainly going to keep his promise. There is no doubt that he will. We need to have that kind of conviction by faith. So when you come back here, he's saying the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Doesn't that seem a little odd? Verse 24. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Once again, notice, when is she finding this out? At delivery, right? So, now I want you to keep in mind, the promise in Genesis 17:4 is about many nations are going to come out of you, Abraham. Just think about the five that we've seen so far. And we really haven't gone very long past that promise. Whenever you think about the Ishmaelites, are a pretty big group. The Kedarites, the descendants of Kedar, are going to be really big. They're even described as being so big, like the Midianites, in terms of they're such a big group. They come through the descendants of Keturah. They're so big you couldn't even count the camels. When it comes to Judges chapter 6 and 7, you come to the Edomites, you come to here the, now we're starting to see what's going to become the descendants of Jacob to be the Israelites. Is God keeping his promises? Over and over and over again. We should be able to notice this trend. So here it is, what's been told in verse 23. The day's come for her to deliver. There's twins in her womb. Verse 25, we'll just call this one baby A for the moment. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Now, I want you to think about this for just half a second. So many times whenever a child is born, they go, well, look at that head of hair. Well, look at him. He's like a hairy garment. My goodness. So you start to look through these things and kind of looking down the road a little bit. He says, he came forth all red. He says, hairy like a garment. They named him Esau. And literally Esau means a doer. A doer. Like we would probably say about somebody, they get things done. They're a doer. Later on, of course, Esau's descendants are going to be known as the Edomites. Edom is going to be the word red. Later on, there's even going to be a group of where they live called Seir, S-E-I-R. And Seir is kind of a funny Hebrew word. It literally means the hairy guys. So you realize there were some genetic things going on where the descendants of Esau, they were just some hairy guys. I just don't know what else to say. That's a long ways down the road from here, but just throw that out for you. So there's Esau, verse 26, baby B. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. And Jacob literally means to take by the heel or to supplant. It carries with it some other connotations as well in terms of he who hides his intentions, he who manipulates other people. You realize this name has a lot of things baked into it that you're about to see unfold through the rest of Genesis. I used to feel really bad for Jacob whenever it would talk about later on, whenever 10 of his sons go together to sell off Joseph, and they basically pretend like Joseph has been killed by a wild animal using the coat of many colors. And he's thinking, what kind of sons would do this to their father? And just to watch him mourn and weep. And I used to feel just really, my heart just went out to him until I realized he's only reaping what he sowed. You think about how many times Jacob was the one who was in trickery, about how things he's going to play up and what he's going to do. And you realize God's faithful. You're going to reap what you sow. So be careful what you're sowing. Make sure you're sowing what's good. And so he gets what he's going to do himself. Now, here it brings it about together. He says, so his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. So how long have they been married? 20 years. Let me plant this little thought in your head. Hopefully you can remember the year you got married. If you would have waited 20 years until you had your first child, and then at that moment you had twins, would that have changed your life? Now here they are. Remember, they were married whenever Isaac was 40. Now here's Isaac who's 60 years old. Now to have these twins. And remember how I told you that generally the book of Genesis is in chronological order? If Isaac is 60 years old, how old would that make Abraham at this point in time? 160. So he was still alive at this point. But in the telling of the book of Genesis, what's already happened earlier in this chapter? They talked about his death at the age of 175. So just know that in general, Genesis is in chronological order, but know there's some exceptions to that rule as we go through. Jerry?
I'm not sure if it had anything to do with it, but Tom and Sarah were married for 10 years before they ever
met. All right, there's 10 years. There's a difference. And so whenever you start to look through here and see, here's Isaac who's 60 years old. And by the way, 12. Isaac's going to, 12 years, Isaac's going to live to be 180 years old. So he's going to really get to see these promises of God as these peoples and nations really start to multiply, even to the point of seeing people who aren't necessarily getting along. Remember, Ishmael moved to this place because, despite his relatives, even to go against them. And at this point in time, it's already told you about Ishmael's death. And, of course, Ishmael's still alive at this point. If Isaac's 60 years old, then Ishmael would have been about 73, 74 years old. So I just want you to kind of understand about when we're going through the book of Genesis, that as you see these things play out, you might think, and which one of these two in verse 27, we'll go ahead and read this. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. If you just look at verse 27, who would you imagine the descendants are going to come through? You might guess wrong, wouldn't you? If you know the story, you know who it's going to be, though. Next week, come back. We want to spend a little bit more time on the last part here of chapter 25. All right.